I appreciate you taking time to chat with me today. Are you on the road in transit as we speak? What's happening in your world these days?
Not quite yet. I will leave New Orleans tomorrow, heading to North Carolina, specifically to Wilmington.
Okay.
Then on to Raleigh and Chapel Hill and Winston-Salem. The Cameron Museum in Wilmington has an exhibit of Treme costumes. That was a big part of the reason why we are putting the book tour there, because we already have some Treme presence. And it's a way of sort of tying another element of the show to what they're already exhibiting.
Well, I want to get into the book and your presence here in Winston-Salem, but what was it like in terms of your takeaway from your experience as road manager for Wynton Marsalis?
Well, by that point, a lot of what Wynton is doing now was being formed, the whole idea of jazz and Lincoln Center, the whole idea of doing more stuff orchestrally and not just small band stuff. And so it was a great experience to learn the music as he was learning it and learning how to expand what he'd been doing previously. Also, it was a great aesthetic education. I mean, even as a writer, the idea of trying to understand how to bring all these different personalities and all this history into the context of one cogent artistic statement was a crucial lesson for me. Plus, I got to travel the world. You know, after a few weeks, our first trip was to South America. My first time going to Argentina and Brazil, countries I still love. Then went over to Europe. And so it was an education for me in a whole lot of ways.
I just got finished watching the 20-minute interview with David Simon and kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of Treme. And it just seems so deep. There's just such a world there. Maybe cuisine's not the way to dive into that.
Well, part of what is interesting about New Orleans is that long before anywhere else in the United States was known for good food, New Orleans had that reputation, even going back to Anthony Trollope in the 1800s. And so there's a long history here, which of course resonates even more now that Americans are discovering American regional cuisine, trying to rediscover the traditions of their ancestors. In New Orleans, we've never lost that. The other thing you find, in fact, this is something I discovered in the course of doing the book, you look at recipes from around the country, and they'll have, for example, New Orleans-style bread pudding, a Creole bread pudding. And the assumption is that these dishes were invented in New Orleans. And in fact, they weren't. They come from England. But New Orleans has put its signature, its stamp on it. And I think the real lesson of New Orleans food is that we need other people in other places need to attempt to find what their traditions are and celebrate them and extend them.
That reminds me of an anthropologist friend of mine, a cultural anthropologist, defending her. She was from Italy, and she was defending going into, in this case, it was neighborhoods in Trinidad and writing about it with that outsider perspective as being completely legitimate, where someone from there would say, what are you doing trying to tell our story for us? But how do you see that whole dynamic? Does someone from New Orleans have to tell that story authentically, or could it be someone from the outside?
The two advantages that people from the outside have. One is that I think New Orleanians often take our culture for granted. And like everyone everywhere else, we think the grass is greener somewhere else. We look at the kind of shiny new things that many of the other great cities of the South have been developing in recent decades. And we say, we wish we had that. The other thing that someone from the outside brings is sort of the fervor of the new convert. They are students of this culture in an academic sense when we New Orleanians assume we know it and therefore don't need to study it. The other thing I'd say about outsiders coming in is that whereas I may go to hear music, live music, you know, once a month or every couple of months, and I may go to a nice restaurant every couple of months, the people who choose to move here are so committed to this culture and so interested in it that I think they probably fuel the ongoing strength of this culture as much, if not in some cases more, than the locals do. So I think the input of locals in terms of our cuisine and our culture is crucial.
A lot of folks who, and myself included, I guess years ago, not all that familiar with the region, might think, you know, New Orleans, in terms of food, just for example, okay, we got your gumbo, some spicy sausage, maybe a blackened fish or something. But the variety of the cuisine, as outlined at least in some of the stories and recipes from the heart of New Orleans in your book, Treme, it's just really staggering. And it's also growing. Some recent, from your research, like recent, not inventions, but evolutions of the cuisine that really grab your imagination.
Well, a big part of what has happened in New Orleans cuisine in recent decades is the influence of the Cajun community and the Cajun tradition. Mind you, Cajun country in Louisiana is southwest Louisiana, and depending on exactly where you're going, an hour or two from New Orleans. And this is largely rural food, Mind you, the Cajuns and the Creoles share the same emblematic dishes, the red beans and rice and gumbo and so forth. But the Cajun influence has reinfused some other Louisiana ingredients into New Orleans cuisine. Additionally, what you have is a rich range of contributions from Africa, from Europe, from the Caribbean to create New Orleans cuisine, with the new infusion of Asian immigrants from Vietnam mostly, and of Latino immigrants largely from Guatemala and Honduras. You have these peoples reinfusing New Orleans cuisine with their influence. So you will often go to a restaurant that is not a Vietnamese restaurant by any stretch and find their version of pho, the Vietnamese soup, or their incorporation of fish sauce or other Vietnamese ingredients. Similarly, tacos are now big in New Orleans. What's interesting to me is that whereas other communities can talk about the ethnic influences in their cuisine and their culture, they're able to differentiate them and say, well, that's the German section, that's the Polish section. In New Orleans, on the plate, it really would be impossible to divide it between which influences came from Africa, which from Europe, which from the Caribbean. For the past couple of hundred years, we've all been cooking together and creating cuisine together.
For me, that's the most beautiful image. And I just see a parallel in the music from Congo Square. There's this mixing of Western classical traditions and I mean the Irish, English, and then the drumming traditions of Africa and so many mm-hmm. coming together in whatever we call jazz or coming to accept it. It seems like the seamless nature of that, or the organic nature of that, what makes it seem so authentic sounding to me. In case of the foods, I've been to plenty of restaurants that are fusion restaurants. It just seems so forced, like I'm going to do this and this. Could you articulate what sets New Orleans fusion cuisine, for lack of a better way of putting that, apart from those others that are just trying but not quite making the mark?
I think a lot of it has to do with the amount of time that it's taken place. I suspect that if either of us had been alive in 1750, it might not have been so neatly fused. The other thing is that in terms of race in southern Louisiana, it's always been a different prospect. I don't want to minimize the brutality of slavery here during that time, but you always had a more fluid mix of the races of black, white, and mixed race. Even legislatively, it was possible for people to buy their own freedom. And therefore, imagine, for example, what happens when you and your enslaved or you and your free relatives are getting together, sharing all of this kind of food that you both have an influence on. The other thing is that much of what happened in the Northeast is a very class segregation of food culture, and that if you were going to a fancy restaurant, it was either going to be French or Italian. That's never been the case here. There have always been fine Creole restaurants, and even though people always talk about them as being, well, it's French food, all of those places have food that is at least as much Senegalese and Congolese as it is French. And so there's a kind of democracy that takes place on the plate here, whereas in the current context, these chefs are engaging in kind of flights of fancy, dealing with food that their mothers never made and never could have imagined. Sometimes they're very successful at it. I don't want to denigrate that at all. But I think the difference here is that the fusion of our cuisines first took place with the fusions of our peoples a long time ago.
Tremé, your book has been described as a celebration of the eclectic and inventive culinary spirit of post-Katrina New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, and I know it depends on where in the city you're talking, whether it's the sliver that somehow survived the storm relatively intact or not, but how would you describe was there a shift, I mean, in terms of the culinary scene in New Orleans pre- and post-Katrina? What are you seeing?
Yeah, and there's several differences. One of the main differences is a recommitment of our fine dining chefs to our food. Mind you, if you're a fancy chef at a white tablecloth restaurant, you're always aware of the possibility of being featured in some major magazine or getting a James Beard Award, et cetera, et cetera. And one way to do that is to try to cook more and more like the people in New York or the people in San Francisco. But at a time right after the federal levee failures, when people were questioning whether or not New Orleans would survive or should survive, each of us had to look within our own genre and figure out a way to express New Orleans, and in so doing, to demonstrate why this place is so crucial. So part of what happened, I remember the first Monday when John Best reopened Restaurant August, he was serving red beans and rice. Restaurant August is a white tablecloth James Beard award-winning restaurant. They would not have done that as readily prior to the flood. Additionally, Donald Link was opening Cochon, his restaurant. That's a celebration of Southwest cuisine. So there's that celebration of our traditions. But additionally, we have these influxes of new people. And at first, there was a kind of reluctance to really embrace Latin Americans, in part because they were brought here to do work when New Orleanians were being prevented from coming back and rebuilding our own city. But as the food trucks began to open to serve Latino immigrants, as the taco trucks were opening, New Orleanians began to talk about not only how good they were, but to compare notes on which ones were the best. And I think that has influenced the current food truck movement here. In terms of food trucks, we're catching up with the rest of the country. But we have to give credit to the Latino immigrants for their influence in terms of that development.
That's interesting to hear about that in New Orleans. I'm going to shift gear just quickly, and this is, just comes on the heels of acquainting myself for the first time with the television program Tremé, and then and the Wire through that interview. That it was the Reason TV interview with David Simon. Could you describe just real quickly your role as a story editor for the HBO series Tremé?
For those of us who come from the world of journalism, the use of the word editor in television is sort of laughable. I didn't quote-unquote edit anything, but I was one of the writers who would help shape the stories and write a script each season. But editor referred to a lot of ancillary writing. For example, on the HBO website, we'd have synopses of what's going on with the episodes. We'd also have to write stuff for award competitions, just sort of synopses of what was going on.
Okay.
But when David Simon and Eric Obermeyer came here to do this show, they were both students of New Orleans and qualified in their own right to tell this story. But they also realized that it would be helpful, and in fact it could potentially deepen what they were doing, to have some local writers involved in the writer's room. There were a lot of local consultants who helped to define the music and the food and the Mayan Indian culture, and we certainly got that right. But having me and Tom Piazza, who's also a New Orleans writer, in the room, I think, helped bring an added level of authenticity to a show that set as one of its main goals the authentic expression of the New Orleanian story.
You won the NAACP Award for one of the stories you wrote, Santa Claus, Do You Ever Get the Blues? Was there a contribution or an approach to that story? And maybe it wasn't that particular episode, but could you talk about a story or contribution you made to that series that you personally are really proud of?
Well, part of what happened with Tremé is that we were trying not to have it be serialized drama in the cliffhanger sense of the word, where you're waiting until next week to find out the whodunit or to find out, you know, whose baby is this, etc. But there's something about having those kind of cliffhangers that I think fuels a show and fuels audience interest. So one of the things I suggested in the first season was that LaDonna, the bar owner character whose brother was lost in the storm, I looked at ways in which people got lost in the context of prison after the storm and the prisoners being moved, etc. Looked at that as a means of having that sort of cliffhanger element. What happened to him? What are the possibilities? And so on one hand, my hope is that you connect with that simply because you're wondering about the solution to this mystery. But on another level, it brings you through one layer of the post-Katrina New Orleans experience, one layer about what happened to people who were caught up in the criminal justice system, often through no fault of their own.
I have to ask, what's it like working with David Simon, the co-creator of Tremé and The Wire? I was transfixed throughout the course of this 20-minute interview. He seems like a very intense person.
He is very intense. I remember one time I was leaving the office and he was coming in. So we're sort of catty corner outside. And so I said hello to him, and it was clear that he had no idea what was going on. He was, as James Thurber's wife used to say, he was writing, meaning he's walking down the street thinking about what he was going to write, thinking about the show. The important thing to understand about David is that he always has a much larger vision in mind than the basic story that's being told. So when he's talking about what was happening in Baltimore and the drug scene there and the police scene, He's also talking about the way in which urban America was crumbling. Therefore, in the second season, you have the docks. Therefore, you have the school system using statistics in a way that had previously failed with the police department and had been seen subsequently to be failing with the education system. In the context of Tremé, he's again looking at what happens when the federal government abdicates its responsibility to protect and defend its people. And so, in addition to that, he also is looking at American culture and the notion that the food and the music and the architectural artisans in New Orleans were crucial to the rebuilding of the city and point the way to a rebuilding of America. So what's great about David is that he can get into the minutiae. He can get into, well, exactly what was the statistic that we're trying to build this dialogue based on. But he also has a broader vision of attempting to tell the contemporary story of this nation. And so in working with him, it's funny because the writer's room is a very democratic environment. Anybody in the writer's room can put up an idea and hope that the best ideas win and get seconded by everybody else. But as the showrunner, he's ultimately the one who decides which ideas we use and which ones we don't. And what became clear, as a lot of good ideas were put up and dismissed, was that he wasn't looking for a good idea. He had a very specific vision of where he was going with the show. And it became clear that our job in large part was to help him realize that vision.
All right. Well, can I bring you back to food?
Please.
I want to talk about this this menu. Is that something you're comfortable talking about? Or
yeah, I don't have it in front of me, but I can speak to each of the dishes.
Okay. I'd love for you to, just off the top of your head, your take on these. Because evidently Meridian Restaurant, a local restaurant here in Winston-Salem, on Monday the 12th is going to celebrate the release of your book, Tremé: Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans. And Chef Mark Groman is going to prepare a menu inspired by the book. And I guess you're going to be on hand to chat up some guests and sign books, which are also going to be available there. As someone, I appreciate fine food. I like the thought that goes into designing a really compelling menu and, of course, the skill that's needed to pull it off. For the non-professional chef, I'm wondering, well, for starters, what needs to go right, say, to pull off this first item here? It looks like it's oysters on the half shell with yuzu mignonette. What is a yuzu mignonette, and what needs to go right to make that really, you know, fly off the palate?
Well, what you really get is a dialogue between the traditional French mignonette, which is a sort of vinegar-based sauce that you use over raw oysters, plus yuzu, which is an Asian citrus fruit, kind of like a Meyer lemon, but also with its own distinct flavor. Plus, you get the fact that y'all are on the coast of North Carolina, so you get traditional oysters from the area. And so it's a mixing of all of those things, which is, again, the story of contemporary New Orleans cuisine.
Now, the next item, I'm familiar with the chicory added to coffee in New Orleans. This is a chicory coffee glazed Manchester Farms quail with chard and a creamy Anselm Mills grits. Now, have you had a chicory coffee glazed dish before? And what can go right, what can go wrong with that combination?
Well, I actually tested that recipe. And in terms of the basic technique of it, it's not a difficult dish because it's not as if you cook it for an extra 30 seconds or 30 seconds too little, it's going to be a major problem. But the great thing about it is the mixing of all these flavors, a mix of things you're familiar with and things you're not familiar with. So certainly you've had grits before, but these grits are incredibly creamy because they're cooked in milk. In terms of the quail, certainly you've had quail, you've had greens of various kinds, but the idea of stuffing the greens into the quail, I think, also gives us this a kind of distinction. And the main thing is just trying to figure out how to get all these things to come together at the same time. The chicory coffee, again, everybody's had coffee. The chicory coffee has a distinctive flavor. We still maintain chicory in our coffee, whereas most of the rest of the country does not do that anymore. You got to figure out how to get the balance right so it doesn't taste so much like coffee as a very rich, dark sauce.
Okay. And then oatmeal and fresh local berry parfait follows with chantilly cream, a new one for me. And what goes into making that cream sing?
Well, it's basically enriched whipped cream. So it's whipped cream with a little taste of vanilla and a little sweetening in it. And the oatmeal and berry parfait is sort of a play on the traditional kind of ice cream parfait. But the idea is you're layering macerated berries, steel-cut oatmeal, and the chantilly cream one after another. And what's interesting is that I usually view this as kind of a brunch dish, and chef has chosen to make it a dessert. But it works as a dessert because you get the sweetness of the berries, and the oatmeal is not too sweet. So you get a nice, refreshing dessert. It's sort of perfect for a warm summer afternoon.
Yeah, I can see a nice combination of textures, too, with the oats and the fruit and cream coming together.
Right, right.
All right. Well, for someone who's not had lunch yet, I think I better leave it right there. I'm getting really hungry. And, Lulis, what didn't we talk about that you'd like to? I'd be happy to ask you a follow-up question.
Well, our greatest ambition in doing this book was to create a book that would be able to stand alone from the show, that you would not have to have seen the show to appreciate. There's a lot about New Orleans food and food history in the book that is not related to the show per se. We have a history of the po' boy sandwich, history of French bread, history of Creole bread pudding, a discussion of Cajun and Creole cuisines and the differences and similarities between the two. So my hope is that if you were to go to the bookstore and see a bookshelf full of New Orleans books, this would be among your top picks. I mean, I can't say that there are not other great books about New Orleans cuisine, but our hope really was to make this as good as any of them, even beyond its connection to the show.
Well, again, thank you very much for taking time out to talk with me today. It was a great phone connection, by the way. It sounds like you're just right in studio. So
great.
Look forward to getting
to it. Well, David, I really appreciate it.
All the best.
Okay.